Don Winslow är ju alltså, han skriver ju en tradition med kaliforniska deckarförfattare som är, går långt tillbaka till Raymond Chandler och dessförinnan också, som har kanske kopplingar till manus, filmmanus skrivandet mycket. Don Winslow, han skrev först en serie med 5 böcker med deckare som hänger ihop, och sen började han skriva fristående romaner som The Life and Death of Bobby Z, som har filmatiserats. Och den filmen har jag inte lyckats se än, men boken är väldigt bra. Och det kan nog vara en väldigt spännande film. Han skrev också California Fire and Life, som är en alldeles fantastisk bok. Som handlar om en man som justerar försäkringsärenden. Och det kan bli mycket mer spännande än vad det låter som. Och hans senaste bok som har kommit ut i USA heter The Dawn Patrol. Och en jättespännande historia om illegal, om människohandel, och ja, den har många dimensioner. Och i sommar så kommer det en uppföljare till den som heter The Gentleman's Hour, som kommer ut i England bara nu i juli, och som handlar, har samma huvudperson. Men hans största bok, för mig åtminstone läsupplevelsemässigt, har varit The Power of the Dog, den boken som nu kommer ut på svenska. Och som sträcker sig, som en otroligt ambitiös roman som sträcker sig över 30 års, och en ganska politisk roman som sträcker sig över alltså 30 års amerikansk utrikespolitik i Mexiko. Fantastiskt spännande och väldigt insiktsfull, och jag är jättenyfiken på hur han har gått till väga för att skriva den här boken, så jag har många frågor till honom sen. Så att om ni har inte läst honom än, så gör det, absolut. Det är en mycket givande och spännande att läsa herr Winslow.
Okej.
Ja.
Ja, den frågan jag hade var att du har tagit med dig lite böcker också.
Ja, precis. Jag har, vi kommer att ha, förutom då hans bok som kommer på svenska som förlaget Voltaire här och har med sig, så kommer, har jag också från English Bookshop med mig en 6 andra titlar som vi kommer att ha till försäljning senare. Och jag förstår, så kommer Dan att signera efter föreläsningen. Mm?
Just, you welcome up here, Don.
Okay.
Just to translate very briefly, he said that all your books are fantastic, but this one is even more fantastic, and he really wants to know how you did it. So you might as well tell him right away, or else he will give you 68 questions,
uh-oh,
and you will miss the train to Stockholm.
No, you can't do that. Which book? Oh, Power of the Dog is a book I never intended to write, actually. What happened was, just across the border from where we live in San Diego, California, it was a massacre of 19 innocent men, women, and children. It was the incident that starts this book. And it was a place that Jean, my wife, and I would go on cheap weekends to play with, you know, people. And then you wonder, how could something like that happen? How do the drug wars, the so-called war on drugs, which I think is a travesty anyway, get to that point? And so I started to research it, you know, and ask those questions. And 5 years later, I turned in a manuscript that was in excess of 2,000 pages long, which my editor, the shortest editorial note in history, which was cut it, you know. And I said, well, how? And they said, in half, you know. And I was a little snarky that day, so I said, well, would you like it cut horizontally, vertically, or diagonally? You know, I borrowed my neighbor's chainsaw. I'll be happy to do that. But basically, it was a matter of, you know, 5 years of research and writing, of going through government documents, court cases, police reports, CIA reports, DEA manuals, talking with former DEA and CIA agents, and talking with gang bangers in San Diego, and yes, drug dealers. So it was a long process. Yeah. Did that answer the question, the 83 yeah, of the 86 questions?
Yeah, he's now down in 2 hours of questioning, okay, so that's very good. I have a few questions,
okay,
for you before you,
yeah,
sort of,
sure,
get the floor. But I read in your on your website that you have the title PI,
mm-hmm,
in your history, yeah, like Magnum PI.
Yeah. Almost as good looking, too.
No, I think you're better, really.
Yeah.
That 2 Tom Selleck's on you.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, is that true?
Yeah, yeah. I was a PI, a private investigator, mostly in New York City when I was much younger, in the Times Square area, before Mickey Mouse took it over, when it was all crack vials and muggers and people like that. My job description for several months was bait. I was set out to troll for muggers. There was hopefully a very, very large man not too far behind me, you know, who would jump in if I found any. And I was on the pickpocket squad in movie theaters, which was more fun than anyone should be allowed to have. Kind of 3D chess in the dark, you know, while Star Wars is playing. And that was fun. And then I did drug buys, you know, bought cocaine and marijuana in small amounts. And then I went on the missing persons watch. So basically my job was to help locate runaway teenagers and get them back.
How, that's my second question, just to get you going. How did you go from that to novel writing?
You know, I'd always wanted to write ever since I was a little kid. That's what I thought, you know, if life worked out the way that I wanted it to, that's what I'd do for a living. You know, but nobody stamps your passport writer, as you know.
Oh, no.
You know, you can't go to school and then, bam, you're a writer.
They don't stamp them at all now anymore.
So. Yeah, that's right. So I took a lot of detours on the way. But then when I got serious about being a writer, I just followed that old saying, write what you know. Hmm? At the time, that's what I knew. I knew about finding runaways. And so my first book was about a young man, a student, in fact, who's sent from New York City to London to bring back a runaway girl. And I got very lucky. I think the first 15 publishers turned it down.
Yeah.
And the 16th took it. And fortunately, thank you, God, I've been writing ever since.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good, because Peter and I have the same experience. We are refused by a lot of nice... A lot of nice 12, yeah. companies.
I was turned down then by the publisher I'm with now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so he seems to be a recent guy then.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay. It's good.
He can change.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So I'm just going to...
Please, yeah. Otherwise, I'll talk, and I'd rather answer questions, actually. Yeah. Yeah, thank you for asking that. I was thrilled when she said that. I've been saying that, frankly, for a long time. In my country, the United States, I think we make up 5% of the world's population. We use somewhere between 20 and 25% of the world's illegal drugs. But I think we have a very nasty habit of pointing the finger at other people and saying that it's the producing country's problem, not the consuming country's problem. So I was delighted when she said that, because I think and I hope it will bring a little equality into the relationship with Mexico vis-a-vis the drug problem. The other thing that she said that I was delighted about is that there's a smuggling problem going in the other direction that we rarely talk about. When you look at the violence that's happening in Mexico now, that's fueled by American weapons. So there's another illicit trade going from north to south, and that's guns. We don't like to talk about that in the United States. We just like to look at the producing countries, principally Colombia and Mexico, to a lesser extent now, I suppose, Afghanistan, and say the problem is there. In reality, if no one in America wanted cocaine, you could stack it up on Miami Beach till Florida fell into the ocean. And it wouldn't make any difference. So thank you for asking that question, and I was delighted to see that we have a bit more of that attitude.
Well, I really don't want to disturb you, so just keep going.
Okay. Well, I thought, and you all tell me what would be interesting to you. The book Jan alluded to is a book about the drug trade from Mexico to America and back and forth, about the Mexican drug cartels, which have been in the headlines lately, and I think maybe even in your papers and television news. And I thought, if it's acceptable and interesting to you, I might give you a brief history of how those cartels came into being and how the drug trade started. It was a bit surprising to me, and then take time for questions. Does that sound like a good use of your time? You know, things are always more complex than they appear to be on the surface. And the Mexican situation, I think, is a great example. There are really only three places in the world where the climate and the soil are perfect for growing the poppy from which the opium-based products are taken. You know, there's South Asia, Afghanistan, certain parts of India. There's the infamous Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. And there's a very narrow corridor of mountains in western Mexico in Sinaloa province that also have the perfect weather, altitude, acidity of soil to grow the poppy successfully. And they've been doing that, you know, since before the turn of the century. Up until World War II, the American government tried to stop it. It was a minor problem in America, opium coming over, principally to supply the Chinese who were working on our railroads along the Mexican border. And we tried to suppress the trade then, but it wasn't a major problem. But we sent ambassadors to Mexico saying, please stop it, please shut it down. Then World War II came along, and America suddenly had a desperate need for opium-based products to make the morphine that we needed for badly wounded soldiers and sailors in the Pacific, because we could no longer get it from Afghanistan or from Southeast Asia because of the German Navy and the Japanese Navy being in the way. So we needed a source for opiates in North America. So our ambassadors went back to Sinaloa, back to these mountains in western Mexico, and now they're saying, please, please, could you grow more opium? In fact, if you go to Sinaloa now, what you will see are lots of narrow-gauge railway tracks, yeah, that help bring the opium products down from those mountains to the market towns. The cartel use them now. Those were built with American money by the American government to help bring that product in. The war ends, a lot of American soldiers and sailors come home with heroin problems, morphine addictions from their wounds. You also suddenly had a large African-American population that had moved from small little towns in the South, rural, very tight-knit family communities, to large industrial cities to work in the factories that fueled the war, and are now suffering all of the emotional and psychological trauma of racism, isolation from their homes, and suddenly, when the war ended, unemployment. So all of a sudden, for the first time in our country, you have a relatively large demand for heroin. It becomes a problem. We send ambassadors back down to Sinaloa province and say, please, please, please stop growing this nasty opium. They're understandably confused. And they have a wicked problem now because their entire economy in those areas is based on growing the poppy, on harvesting opium. So if they stop doing that, you would suddenly have massive unemployment, rural starvation, all kinds of economic problems in these tiny villages. There were some other ambassadors who went down to Mexico in the late 1940s, and that was the American Mafia, the West Coast version. In fact, Bugsy Siegel, perhaps you saw the movie a number of years back with Warren Beatty. Bugsy Siegel went down to Sinaloa, met with the governor of Sinaloa, and said to that gentleman, we'll buy all of the opium that our government no longer wants. You produce it. We'll buy it and distribute it. It'll be business as usual. And so down these narrow gauge railways that the American government built comes the opium products and the heroin. The LA, Los Angeles-based mafia was a colony, a subset really run by the Chicago and Detroit mafias. And so this distribution system burst across America from the West Coast immediately to Chicago and Detroit and these big industrial cities in the north where there was a huge market. Again, the entire economy of this area of Mexico becomes dependent upon this trade. And this goes on for years and years up through the Vietnam War, where we discovered a new market for heroin, a new source for heroin. In fact, it's fairly well known that our own Central Intelligence Agency helped to fly heroin around, you know, to support the anti-communist drug dealers against communist insurgents in Southeast Asia. Nevertheless, Richard Nixon, in 1973, President Nixon declared the so-called war on drugs to stamp out drug use in America. Unfortunately, roughly 80% of the funding of that was drug interdiction, to stop drugs from coming in, and only 20% on drug treatment and education. And one of the major efforts in 1975 was in this Sinaloa province in the mountains of Mexico. The Mexican government, the Mexican army in this area, and the federal police launched a major drive through the mountain valleys of this area to literally stamp out the poppy fields. They dropped Agent Orange poison on them. They burned the fields. They literally invaded this country and drove the villagers out. And the Mexican gentleman who was in charge of cooperating with the Americans on this was a man named Miguel Angel Gallardo, who was the assistant to the Sinaloa government and, sorry, Peter, but the second highest-ranking policeman in Sinaloa province. And he was the man who pointed out which opium fields to burn, who was doing what where. What was not known to the American DEA at that time was that Miguel Angel Gallardo was also the second largest opium grower in Sinaloa province. And he used this campaign, Operation Condor, to wipe out his rivals. So that all of the fields, the people who were arrested, there were a number of killings, assassinations really, Miguel Gallardo used to become, go from number two to number one. As soon as this operation was over, Gallardo gathered all of the surviving gomeros, which is slang for opium grower, gomero meaning gum, the gum of the, that comes out of the poppy plant, in a restaurant in the city of Guadalajara, Mexico. The restaurant that evening was guarded by Mexican police, federales, and the Mexican army from prying eyes. It's a room, in fact, not unlike this room. And he gathered all these men around the table. And to me, it's an example of the law of unintended consequences. What the American DEA and the Mexican government had intended to do was crush the opium trade. What they did was to mastize it like a cancer. Because Gallardo, whose nickname was M1, gathered the surviving gomeros who were now loyal to him in a single room, and he did several very, very smart things. One, he said, gentlemen, you don't want to be in the drug business anymore. You don't want to be in the growing business because you see what can happen. You know, people can come in and burn you, poison you, shoot you, kill you, and arrest you. Those days are over. What you want to be is Federal Express. Basically, you want to be UPS. You just want to be the delivery system for other people. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to divide Mexico up into plazas, territories. And he sat there at this table and he said, you have Baja, you have Sinaloa, you have the Gulf, you have Juarez and the New Mexico, Arizona, Texas borders, and you will run those territories. And then he did something that was revolutionary in the drug business. He said, we're done with heroin for the time being. We're going to get into the cocaine business. Because at this time, the Medellin and Cali cartels in Colombia were shipping lots and lots of cocaine into America. It became epidemic, and they were doing it through Florida. I don't know how, you know, if you have this geography in mind. And the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, was doing a pretty good job of shutting the Colombians down in Florida. And they were looking for a back door into the country. And Gallardo set up a system. He took these men literally from the restaurant to another building and introduced them to a man named Ballesteros, who did a little chemistry experiment on the table in front of them with cocaine. Lit a couple of matches, a few chemicals, you know, bango, zango, abracadabra. This is called crack. This highly reductive, highly powerful, very cheap, albeit potent form of cocaine. Gallardo cut a deal with the Colombians, both cartels, Medellin and Cali, the major, and he said, look, you deliver your cocaine to Mexico and forget about it. We'll deliver it back to you in California, New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas. You'll pay us a percentage of what that's worth, and we'll just deliver it for you. This became known as the Mexican trampoline. Because what they did was they bought a fleet of small airplanes that could fly under radar. And they would fly them from Colombia to various ports in Central America, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama, Honduras, refuel. fly them into Guadalajara, Mexico, and then they do what they call smurfing. You remember the little cartoon, little blue characters? They cut big units up into little tiny units. So the American DEA agents assigned to Guadalajara would sit on a plateau over the Guadalajara airport, watch these planes come in, watch them be offloaded by Mexican federal police and the army into small vans and trucks that would then be smurfed out to all these various plazas at various points along the American border, and then brought into America via tunnels, via car, via boat, all kinds of creative things, sometimes just air flights over into the desert, redelivered back to the Colombians on the other side of the border. This trade was so lucrative that it created absolutely billionaires out of what became known as the Federation, El Federacion, one gigantic organization in Mexico. This went on for years. The American DEA agents in Guadalajara kept sending messages back to Washington, D.C. and to their bosses. The cocaine that you don't see coming into Florida, it's coming through Mexico. It's coming through the back door. What they were told by their bosses is Washington was shut up. Shut your stupid mouths if you ever want to work again or you want to keep your jobs, because American politicians and Mexican politicians had appeared together in press conferences in Washington and announced victory in Mexico. And they showed you burnt poppy fields and arrests and all of that. Show that. So the agents literally on the ground in Mexico were told to shut up. There were two of them that didn't. One of them was captured by the cartel, tortured to death in the presence of M1, Miguel Angel Gallardo, an American DEA agent named Kiki Camarena. His partner went kind of mad, ended up trying to arrest Gallardo in Mexico. Gallardo escaped to his palace in Costa Rica. The DEA followed him to Costa Rica, staged a raid, arrested him, were taking him to the American embassy when Costa Rican police and American CIA agents interfered and forced them to free Gallardo. It turned out that Gallardo was funding the Contras in their war against the Nicaraguan, the Sandinistan government. In fact, had a training camp that he paid for and supplied and armed. And so he was freed in order to resume his war against the communists in Central America. The Mexican trampoline worked in two directions, it turned out. What would happen is that the American Congress cut off funding to the Contras. They had to find a way to fund them. The Contras said, "We have an idea. Cocaine is very profitable." So they got into the cocaine business, and they would buy Colombian cocaine, fly it to Mexico to be smurfed into units, sold in America. That money would be used to buy arms, be snuggled back into Mexico, back into those same airplanes that then would make the return journey, land in Costa Rica, Honduras. The arms would be offloaded for the Contras, and they would fight Ronald Reagan's war in Central America. So what you had was one department of the American government fighting the so-called war on drugs, clashing directly with another agency of the American government, the National Security Council, that was fighting the secret war that was part of all of the Iran-Contra. I don't know if you know, you're all familiar with that in Sweden here. This went on for a number of years, and then it all fell apart. People got greedy. They started to fight over control of these plazas. Gallardo, in one of the great ironies that as a writer you can't make up, if you did make it up, your editor would throw it out, himself became a crackhead. Became addicted to crack, became addicted to his own product, and went quite mad, was eventually arrested by the Mexican government because he'd become a nuisance, and spent a few years in prison, but not before he turned the business over to his nephews, the Arellano Felix brothers. There were seven of them, like the seven dwarfs, but they're not quite as cute or funny, extraordinarily violent people who then fought with the Juarez cartel and the Gulf cartel for control of the Mexican drug trade. They also sort of learned lessons from American capitalism of the day. And what they discovered was they no longer wanted the sort of classic organized crime triangle structure. Because if you were at the top of that triangle, you automatically became a target. And Benjamin Arellano Felix, who ran the organization, he was an accountant, actually, took his uncle's theory yet one more step. And he said, look, we don't want to be involved with drugs at all. Never touch them. Don't bother with them. And he set up a horizontal business model. And what he did was, in Tijuana and other northern cities, they literally seduced the sons of the rich. They infiltrated these cities. They went to the best restaurants, to the ballet, to the opera, to theater. They became patrons of the arts. They hung around with the very rich people. They took the sons and daughters of congressmen, judges, businessmen, doctors out to dinner. They flew them to Las Vegas for boxing matches. And then they said to them, you know what? I can show you a way to make as much money and more than daddy makes. Here's what you want to do. Go down to Colombia. Get yourself a boatload or an airplane load of coke. Bring it through our territory. You know what? We'll even finance it for you. At a rate, 6%. You bring it through our territory. And all they provided was protection. Okay? They had the army bribed. Again, sorry, they had the local police bribed. And we can talk more about that in detail because the Mexican police are in a very, very difficult situation in regards to that. They offered financial services. They said, look, now you've got all this cash in America and you don't know what to do with it. It's a hassle getting it back. You have to launder it. People can rob you. You can get raided. I'll tell you what. Pay us 6% to bring the product through, sell it on the other side, and then we'll launder the money for you at a discount. 3%. And so they would send the money then around the world, to principally to the Cook Islands and Vanuatu and places like that. So you could deal with the Arellano Felix brothers, buy cocaine in Colombia, ship it through, know that it was safe. They would guarantee it, by the way. They'd say, if it's busted by the police or by the army or anyone else, we'll replace your money. It was a great deal. And they knew that they were protected. Because these were the sons of the most prominent citizens in these cities in Mexico, that if they did get in trouble, had access to the best lawyers, to all kinds of power and things. They also did some other interesting things. Is this at all interesting to you? I don't know how I'm doing for time, or I just feel like I'm kind of yapping. But, you know, some of the cliches that you see in movies are not necessarily true. For instance, if you were one of these drug dealers and you were arrested in the United States, the Arellano Felix, the cartel, didn't tell you to shut up. They didn't insist that you remain silent. They'd say, talk. Tell them everything you know. Get yourself the best deal that you can. Just tell us first. And so what would happen is that a Mexican or American drug dealer would get arrested in Texas or California or wherever. It's a federal crime, taken to a federal lockup. The first thing you get in America is a right to a lawyer. That lawyer works for the cartel. And you have a right to meet in private. And what you would do is tell that lawyer everything you were going to tell the police. Everything that you just tell him first. And he'd go back down to the cartel and he'd say, this route is blown. That runner is blown. This policeman's compromised. They know about this. They know about that. They'd change it all up. You, as the witness, cut the best deal you can. Get your sentence reduced by ratting out on someone who's now changed his entire operation. I used to go out with the Border Patrol in San Diego, and right across the border from, you know, here to that block of buildings across this little open plaza, I guess, was Mexico. There were three big apartment towers, 13-story towers. Those were all owned by the cartel. And they would station people there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with binoculars, watching the border crossings. so they would know when their bribed American Border Patrol people were at certain lanes of traffic. And then the drug dealers who were driving the drugs through in specially built cars would just telephone up or text, get a code, 777, you know, meant you're clear on that lane, keep going. 333 meant, nope, change lanes, turn around, don't do it, right? And they'd keep track. They also had a $300,000 bounty on American Border Patrol, anyone who could shoot one from one of those apartment buildings. You know, so we used to go up on the facing slope of this hill and crawl from our little vehicle into an armored vehicle, you know, to sit there and watch this operation. So when you see these headlines now about violence in the cartels, what has happened is that the Mexicans and Americans had a certain amount of success lopping off the top of the Arellano Felix organization, but all that ever does is create job openings. And the jobs are so lucrative, you're talking billions and billions of dollars, that it's worth killing over. You know, it's worth a lot of bloodshed to occupy those positions. So now the what's left of the Arellano Felix cartel is in a blood struggle for this territory against other cartels. The Mexican government, I think, is making a legitimate effort to try to stop this, but they're literally outgunned and outbudgeted. Back in 1996, the Mexican cartels literally and purposely crashed the Mexican economy. They threatened the Mexican government. They said, lay off or else. And what they did was they bought up money futures called tesebonos. They bought up Mexican currency futures at a discount. They had billions of dollars. The Mexican president refused to stop fighting the drug cartels, and they said, watch. They sold them all off at a discount in one day. The Mexican peso crashed. President Clinton at that time had to ram through Congress an emergency bill to float the Mexican peso back up. They have that kind of economic and military power. In terms of, for instance, computer coding and all of that, they can hire the best computer experts in the world. They can hire better experts than the American DEA can hire. And so they're well above us in terms of that technology, you know, coding and surveillance and all of that kind of thing. So when we look at the Mexicans and we say, we shake our fingers, as again we have a bad habit of doing, and saying you need to do this, you need to do that, they make a very good point. It's very, very difficult. And they're literally in a shooting war, costing more lives than were lost in Iraq last year. You have a lot of, I would say, the majority of Mexican police who are very, very honest and try. But, you know, in America, a criminal would never think, or rarely think of ever harming a police officer. In Mexico, those rules don't exist. They will not only kill a police officer, they will kill his family. And so they offer him an alternative. They call it silver or lead. Which do you want? You can either take the bribe, or you can take the bullet. And because they're so outgunned and outmanned, very often, you know, they're forced to take the bribe. So it's not quite as simple, you know, as one might think. I feel a shadow coming over me from behind. So I think I'd probably, it is. I should probably stop here.
Not really. It's, I don't know. Are you sensible about trains? Do we have time, or should we stop here? Okay. So it's actually the National Swedish Railroads.
Okay, yeah.
It's on their behalf. So, right. And it was a good place to stop, wasn't it?
Great, okay.
So I think we should allow a couple of questions anyway.
Yes. Well, I've never spoken Swedish, so.
Well, good for you. Anyway, I wonder over something. You gave a very, very interesting, fascinating, and scary picture over the drug dealing vis-à-vis Mexico, Colombia, and the United States. Mm-hmm. What I wonder is, you gave a couple of reasons why people use drugs. Mm-hmm. The American soldiers from Vietnam and so forth, and poor people coming from small villages from the south mm-hmm. to the north. Okay, but are they enough to make all these people in Mexico and Colombia so rich?
No.
What kind of people in the United States are using drugs? And why are they doing it?
If I could answer that, ma'am. You know, I think that's a very, very varied answer, and I probably don't have time to go into it all, and you wouldn't want me to. It depends on the drug. In methamphetamine, for instance, I make a joke out of it, which I shouldn't, but you finally found a drug that white trash likes and can afford, and so that's one drug. Marijuana, you know, vastly popular. And, you know, I try to tell people, go ahead, have a good time, but it has the blood of children on it, yeah? Cocaine, heroin, a whole different issue.
May I interrupt you?
Of course, yeah.
We have drugs problems here in Sweden mm-hmm. also, but I don't think you answered my question.
Okay, sorry.
I look at it in a more philosophical mm-hmm. way, namely because I think the American people, mm-hmm. the American society, the American economy, the capitalism, if you like, mm-hmm. maybe create this enormous urge for drugs. What is it that make these young people so lost?
Yeah.
That they have to. I don't care if it's amphetamine,
right.
or if it's crack, or if the drugs are good. Or
right.
I wonder why do they start?
Yeah.
What is the problem? Do you understand what I mean?
I think I do, but here's the thing. If you track drug use over the years, to the extent that you can, because there are no accurate figures, understand. Okay, which is another problem. You will find, with very rare occasional spikes, the percentage of the population that uses is roughly the same. So that says that there's something on a biological basis, if you will, that makes certain people, yes, but it's true, susceptible, okay, to that. Are there economic issues? Without question. Are there sociological issues? Yes, without question. But that doesn't answer a certain question. If it's socioeconomic, if it's political, if it's the system, then why is not every poor person doing it? It's only a percentage of them. Yeah? Now, we have a country of 300 million people. So if you take that percentage versus the percentage of population here in Sweden, that's where that vast amount of money comes from. Well, because of this. No, ma'am, I'm trying. Please. I'm trying to tell you. Okay? If this costs 30 cents here, but it costs $30 here, this is no longer the product, ma'am. The product is the ability to move this from here to here. So then you have to ask yourself the question, what's the difference between here and here? Well, there's a border. Fine, that begs the question. What about that border? Well, the answer is, it's illegal here. Yeah? Okay? And he has enough money to buy it here. He doesn't. Okay, it's a difference in that case between the third world and the first world. Yeah? So it's the prohibition of it that creates the enormous profits. Otherwise, it's 30 cents, and I wouldn't bother to make that dangerous trip.
What we need now is one short last question with a short answer.
Yes, sir.
You surf or do it yourself?
A bad one.
Oh, yeah? But you're interested.
Oh, yeah, no, I grew up on the ocean and surfed, and, yeah, we used to live right on the coast and did more of it than I do now. We live inland, but, yeah.
You sell it well in the books.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but we have to stop it. We could have talked to you for hours. I hope you come back here and talk to us again.
I would love to come back. Thank you. I'd love that.
We talk to your publisher about that, the necessity of that.
I would love to come back to Sweden and spend more time.
Let's give a warm hand for Don.